I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast, where we talk about the history of bodybuilding, and we also talk to the legends of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we have a special guest. His name is John Little, and John used to be a writer for Flex Magazine, and he has also, since that time, written a lot of books on his own, particularly about Mike Mentzer, and that's going to be the subject of our discussion today. We're going to talk about Mike Mentzer's life, about his training style, and about his unfortunate passing in 2001. It was this month in 2001, I think it was June 10th, that Mike passed away at the age of 49 years old. So we are going to talk about Mike Mentzer, and John has also written several books and also produced some videos about Bruce Lee. So we're going to talk about Bruce Lee as well in this interview. So it's going to be really interesting. In fact, we went so long, it's actually going to be a two-part interview. And in this part of the interview, we're going to mostly talk about Mike Mentzer and about the 1980 Olympia, about his training style, and about Arnold's influence on Mike to quit bodybuilding and what was happening with the IFBB at that time. So it's going to be a really interesting interview. All right, before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number, which is 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. And if you tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast, they will give you a free consultation, plus they'll give you 20% off your order. All right, so last week's episode with Peter McGough got some really good feedback. If you guys ever want to email me about any of the shows that we've done or any thoughts you have, just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I'll be happy to read your email on the air. I did get a couple emails last week. Rex wrote in, and he said, "Hey, John, I greatly enjoyed your Jeff King and Judge Walter interviews. How about trying for a Don Howarth interview? I read somewhere he was invited to the Olympia but declined." That's a storyline there, huh? "I really want to hear from these older guys before they pass on. I'm hoping your viewership feels the same way." And I told Rex that we did already interview Don Howarth probably about 2 years ago, I think in 2018. So I showed him where to find that. But yeah, I did interview Don. He talked about when he won the America over Frank Zane, I think back in 1967. The year before Frank finally won it, and the IFBB, that was the big show they held every year in New York with the Olympia, the World, the Universe, and the America. So Don had one of those great classical physiques with the huge shoulders, and he was a big Vince Gironda advocate. He talked a lot about Vince in that interview. Also got an email from Scott Barron, one of our Patreon supporters, and Scott said, "I really enjoyed listening to your recent Peter McGough interview. Once again, excellent historical work. Funny question, what the hell ever happened to the guy who sang the theme song to Pumping Iron?" And then Scott wrote me back the next day and he said, "I just researched the composer to the theme song of Pumping Iron, and I was saddened to learn that Michael Small passed away in 2003 of prostate cancer at the age of 64. So Michael Small was the one who did the theme song for Pumping Iron. I also got a review of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast on Apple iTunes. So if you're listening to our show on Apple iTunes, please go to their page and you can rate our show. Give us 5 stars if you like it. And then you could also leave a review. We got another review here from Gorilla Cookie. And he said, "Old school magic. John has so much passion for the sport and he brings back wonderful memories. The stories are priceless and hearing the giants of the sport tell stories is wonderful. There are so many classes now and no strong personalities unlike back in the day. Highly recommend it. So thank you to Gorilla Cookie for that excellent review. Let's see, I think we also got some reviews on my Facebook page where I listed the Peter McGuff interview. Maz said, one of the greatest and most passionate bodybuilding writers of all time. Pete Pingle said, right on, John, this will be great. And Joe Verdoz said, another great interview. I keep worrying that there are a finite number of golden era legends, but you keep finding them and producing must-see TV. Great work, John, and thank you. Thank you, Joe. Yeah, I was wondering that myself. I thought when I started this podcast 3 years ago, it would only last about a year because I thought I would run out of people to interview, but we're going on 3 years. July 4th will be our third anniversary. So knock on wood, we can keep it going. I also put the Peter McGuff interview on my YouTube page. I made it a video since we did it over Zoom and got some comments on that. X Gamer said, I love his stories. I know he's dealing with cancer. I hope he beats it. Stay strong, Peter. Gabriel said, one of our great bodybuilding historians. Stay strong, Peter. The Spritz said, my favorite author. When he used to write for the magazines, they were great. Lee said, I have to say that 1 hour and 6 minutes felt like 20 minutes. Great interview. I love Peter McGuff's perspective and memories of the good times. Tony said, wow, I just received this on my phone. This is going to be incredible. Thanks for the fantastic content, John. Keep it going. Stefano said, when today's guys stand relaxed, they flare their lats out and they try to suck their stomachs in. And when they truly relax their stomach, it pops out so much, regardless of how much muscle they possess, they look simply grotesque. When you compare them to Frank Zane and so many of the guys from the 60s to the early 90s, compare Phil Heath at his last Olympia in 2018 to Sergio Oliva in 1967. Who looks better? Most importantly, Phil Heath took way more drugs and actually looks way worse. That should tell you something. Maz said, great podcast, John. This is less a case of interviewer and interviewee and more a case of two friends reminiscing fondly. Great stuff. Johan said, it would have been much better for bodybuilding if Sean Ray would have beaten Dorian Yates. Yates looked like globs of melted candle wax. At least Paul Dillette put it all together correctly, but he couldn't pose if his life depended on it. Insulin doesn't make for a better body at all. And Madden agreed and said, spot on. Sean Ray, Flex, and Kevin needed to win in the 90s to change the direction it was heading. St. Quinn said, look at minute 419. Sergio's physique lasts by a mile. I put a picture of the top. I think the five guys were in the 72 Olympia, and Sergio was relaxed, so he thinks he should have got last. Mickey said, another great interview with a superb guest. I was kept thoroughly interested the whole time, listening to all of Peter's wonderful stories from the golden era and beyond. He has an extensive wealth of bodybuilding information that is always a pleasure to listen to. Greetings and very best wishes from Northern Ireland. All right. Daz Star said, I love Peter. It was probably biased being a Brit. Madden said, such amazing content. Thank you, Peter. I wish you good health. Frank said, it's apples and oranges. You can only be the best in your era. However, I think if you pick the best year of each multi-winner, the 2009 Jay Cutler beats just about everyone. Ripped to the bone, huge size, and a small waist. It would be interesting. And Old School Bodybuilding Routine said, Arnold. All right. So that is our reviews of the Peter McGuff interview last week. I'm glad you guys liked it. I really love talking to Peter, and I'm glad he's doing well. I know he's fighting cancer, and he's still going through the chemo, so I really appreciate when he makes time to talk to us, because I know sometimes I'm sure he's not feeling up to it, but he always makes time to talk to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, so I really do appreciate that. I'm reading a few bodybuilding books right now. Speaking of John Little, our guest today, I bought his book called The Wisdom of Mike Mentzer, The Art, Science, and Philosophy of a Bodybuilding Legend. And it's available on Amazon. It's really good. It's called The Wisdom of Mike Mentzer. And it's got a lot of stuff in there about Mike's ideas about training, of course, but also about posing, his philosophy. And it's got some great pictures. And I forgot how great Mike Mentzer really was. When you see some of these great pictures that were taken by, I think, like the Weider Archives, I think that's where they got most of them. And Chris Lund took quite a few of them, especially from the 79 Olympia and the 80 Olympia. I also bought Robbie Robinson's book, which I never read, and I'm dying to read it because one of our Patreon sponsors, Pat Comer, who always sends me articles to read on the air, he said this was one of the best books he's ever read. I think he said it was the best book about bodybuilding he ever read. So it's called The Black Prince, My Life in Bodybuilding, Muscle versus Hustle. And I think Robbie did two books, so this is volume one. So I looked through it. It looks really interesting. I can't wait to read this. And I just started reading today Dorian Yates' autobiography, which I tried to order about 6 months ago, and it wasn't available. But it's called Dorian Yates From the Shadow, and it's his official biography and looks really interesting. It's got some great pictures in there too. So that's what I'm reading right now. I'll keep you guys up to date on how they turn out. But they all look like great books. All right. And then finally, before we get to our interview with John Little to talk about Mike Mentzer, I do want to mention my John Hansen Summer Fitness Challenge. And we got a lot of competitors last week. So now they have completed 1 week. So if you guys are interested in being part of the challenge, I know we're down 1 week, but we still have 11 weeks to go. Just go to johnhansenfitness.com. It's right there on the opening page. And you can sign up. And I will be your fitness coach for 12 weeks. In addition to that, I'll also be writing you out a diet and training program. So that will get you going initially, and then I'll be your coach every week. Make sure you're losing the fat, if that's what you're trying to do, or gaining muscle, or both. And I'm excited to work with these guys this summer and see what real big changes we can make. So I'm really going to be involved with all of them. I'm going to be reaching out to them tomorrow on Monday, which is my day off, and make sure they're all making progress and try to keep up with all of them so they have this great transformation by Labor Day, because we're going to go all the way through the summer to Labor Day. In fact, I'm going to start my diet tomorrow too. I haven't been on a diet for almost probably a year and a half. I think the last time I got down to a real lean condition was December of 2018. Yeah, so it's been a year and a half. So I'm tired of being bulked up. I'm going to lean down, and I'm going to do it with these guys. So I'm starting my diet tomorrow. So if you guys are interested, like I said, just go to johnhansenfitness.com. Or if you know somebody that would benefit from this, tell them about my website. And I've also got a lot of other programs on there too, including contest prep. So if you're anybody out there who wants to compete in a contest, I'm helping one guy out right now, Jim Lucas. And he's going to be doing a show in the fall, two shows in the fall, two natural shows. So he's very excited. He's making some great progress. He's got a ways to go, but we got quite a few months left. So I'm looking forward to seeing how Jim does. All right. So that is it for our opening. Here is our interview with Mr. John Little, where we're going to talk about the life and career of Mike Mentzer. Here we go. All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And my special guest this week is Mr. John Little. And John was a writer for Flex magazine. And he wrote several books that we're going to talk about today, including books about Mike Mentzer, who's going to be our main subject, and also Bruce Lee. So, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, John. I got to say, I do enjoy your show very much. I've been getting into it during this whole pandemic, so
yeah,
marathoning your episodes.
Oh, great. Awesome. Glad to hear that. Well, John, I thought we'd bring you on to talk about Mike Mentzer. Mike died, I think it was in 2000, correct?
2001.
2001, yeah. Okay. And he just, yeah. It was this month in June was the anniversary.
Yeah, June 10th.
Yeah, June 10th. So we've never had a show where we talked directly about Mike Mentzer. We've talked a little bit about him. So I thought it would be interesting to have you on since you've written some books about him and everything. When did you meet Mike? Because I was reading one of your books about him, and you said that you've known him for like 20 years, I guess, before he died, right?
Yeah, I first met Mike at a bodybuilding, they called it a breakfast seminar in Toronto.
Okay.
Where Arnold and Franco and Mike Mentzer came to Toronto to a Simpsons department store.
Okay.
And they had a big breakfast seminar, and this was exactly 6 months prior to the 1980 Mr. Olympia contest.
Hmm.
And they all came out and said a little speech and talked, you know, sort of a micro seminar. And of course, at the time I knew who Mike was, and a friend of mine where I live up here was a huge Mike Mentzer fan. But to me, I was all about Arnold and Zane. Those were my guys. So Mike was interesting and somewhat professorial in his presentation. And so I took a Super 8 sound movie camera with two rolls of film, which were about 5 minutes each or something.
Okay.
And I had some friends that were Mentzer fans, so I felt obliged to get some Mike Mentzer material. And I videotaped him and, you know, had audio with it. And then the real stars came on. Franco came on and did a little bit and then bent the microphone in half, you know, pulling onto it with his teeth. And
right.
And then Arnold came out and the place went crazy, you know, and he was, because Arnold was the guy. I mean, he was doing movies. He was doing television. He was the undisputed king of bodybuilding.
Right.
And there he was in Toronto, you know, and we used to buy the magazines and it was all about California, California, California. So
right.
He was in Toronto. So this was amazing, you know? And so the bulk of, I have one reel, which is nothing but Arnold's seminar or his presentation. And the first reel is about a third Arnold, maybe a third Mike and a third Franco. And, you know, in retrospect, I wished I'd reversed the sequence, but
yeah.
And unfortunately I've lost the reel that had Mike and Franco on it.
Oh, wow.
All these moves I have made, but I still have the one with Arnold. So, but that was the first time I met him. That was in 1979. And, after Mike had spoken and Arnold had spoken and Arnold and Franco, they were gone. Took off. Mike stayed behind and there was, as they have in these meeting rooms, these banquet rooms, you know, these sliding walls, and Mike was behind there. And I noticed that Kathy Gelfo, who was his girlfriend, was standing close to the door, basically. So I went up and started speaking to her and she was very gracious. And within 3 minutes, Mike showed up. So we got to talk to him, got his autograph. He was very nice. And he told me when he came over, jokingly, so I was getting jealous, you talking to my girlfriend over there, you know. And I said, yeah, right, you know. And then I remember he repeated that about 10 years later. He goes, no, I really was. He goes, I didn't know who you were talking to over there. So.
How old were you at that time, John?
I was first year of college, so I was probably 20.
Okay.
20-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Might have been 21. I think I was 20, though. I was in my prime, and I was a real threat to Mike Mentzer in terms of the ladies. But that was the first time I met Mike, and he was very, very nice. I actually got Arnold's autograph that day and Mike's, and I was pretty happy. And then also had the movie film to go back, and I must have played it. When I played all the tapes back, the only bodybuilders who imparted anything of substance was Mike. He was talking about the intensity to ratio being inverse and how you can train hard or you can train long, but you can't do both. But it just so happens it takes hard training to build big muscles. I remember this verbatim because I watched it over and over. And then Franco came out and he did kind of a silly little demonstration. He called some guy up from the audience and he said, all right, I want you to try and pull your arm up and I'll resist you. So the guy did it and, you know, Franco resisted him. And then he goes, all right, now bend your arm up to here. And he put two fingers there and said, try and press. And the guy was having trouble moving Franco. And Franco said, see, your triceps are weak. Never mind that you're in a position of insufficiency where you can't engage the muscle. But that was Franco's bit. And then Arnold came out. And it was funny, actually, because, you know, Mike was all about intensity. And he had this voice where he talked sort of like this. And Arnold came out and he looked around. And he saw that Mike was gone. He'd cleared the stage here. So his opening line to the crowd was, you know, how Mike Mentzer trains won't work for you. And then all of a sudden, Mike peeks his head out from behind the partition and looks at him, and he goes, but then what works for me might not work for you. What works for Frank? You have to buy all the books and courses of everybody. So it was entertaining that he was sort of caught red-handed on that one.
Arnold didn't give any indication at all that he would be going in the 80 Olympia, huh?
Not at all. And someone from the crowd had said, because Franco, you know, quick to peel off his shirt and everybody was applauding. And the crowd was saying, you know, Mentzer, let's do it. You know, take off your shirt. Let's see a pose. And he goes, I'm not in contest shape yet. He said, but I will if Arnold will. And Arnold was like, no, I'm not interested, you know. Arnold at that point probably knew he would be heading toward the Mr. Olympia contest, but neither one of them were, or Arnold particularly, was not showing his cards at that point.
Wow. He said this was about 6 months, right, before the Olympia?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think it was in April, I think of April. April, yeah.
I remember the seminar, it was covered in Muscle Mag, right?
Muscle Mag did a write-up on it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was a good crowd. There was about 500 people, 600 people there.
Wow, no kidding.
Wasn't bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was cool, and that sort of turned me a little bit toward Mentzer.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought, only when I was watching the films, because I went back to pan the gold, you know, all these bodybuilding secrets that were going to morph me into Arnold Schwarzenegger.
And
I just found that Arnold didn't impart anything tangible to me that I could apply. To say you should buy all of the books and courses of all of the different bodybuilders and see what works for you seemed like a a huge financial burden, number one, to a student, but also it was instruction that meant nothing. It'd be like you asking me, you're in Florida, I'm in Ontario, and you saying, what's the quickest way to get to Ontario, John, if I want to visit you? And I say, well, geez, you could take a canoe, you could take a helicopter, you could take a plane. I mean, you really should try all the different forms of transportation and find out which one works best for you.
Right.
So it was, that was my experience with Arnold. Then, of course, the 80 Olympia happened, and that raised an eyebrow, certainly, on my part. And I got to know Mike better throughout the years after that. More as a friend than just a fan, you know.
Wow. So you became friends with him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was impressed with the way he dealt with people. Like, mm-hmm. he was, you know, at that time, his star was at its zenith in the Weider publications.
Yeah.
And yet he stayed behind to talk to whoever and whoever wanted to speak with him for as long as they wanted to.
Yeah.
And very free with whatever advice he had. And I think he really enjoyed talking to bodybuilders who were as awestruck with bodybuilding as he was.
Hmm.
He was its biggest fan. You know, whatever magic you experienced when you first got into bodybuilding, that enveloped Mike. He loved that. And for some of us, like myself, become quite cynical over the ages, you know, but there's other people that hang on to the magic of it and still get excited about a physique contest or a new bodybuilder that has another level of development above the rest. And Mike was that way. He loved bodybuilding. It was his ethos. You know?
Wow, really? Hmm. So when did you become interested in writing then, John? Were you a writer in college?
Not really. The only writing I did, I had a friend in high school who was sort of rebellious. He used to write these, whatever the teacher would ask him to write, he would write it, but it would be just so off track of what the teacher wanted that he wasn't going to get a good grade. But his writing was spectacular. And I was so impressed with his writing, and I'd go home and try and emulate it on certain essays. But no, I had no dreams of being a writer at all. In fact, my coming into writing and bodybuilding occurred at about the same time that Mike Mentzer disappeared from bodybuilding.
Oh, okay.
And at the time, I thought, where is the voice of high-intensity training? It's not in the publications.
Yeah.
And so I happened to meet the acquaintance of Chris Lund, who was a bodybuilding photographer,
yeah.
Bob Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
later for Weider. But Chris was very popular because he was the only bodybuilding photographer that had a Hasselblad camera. So the photographs were amazing. You know,
yeah, they were.
Black
they
and
were.
Whites were like, you could see every bead of sweat.
Yeah.
And he and I became friends. And over time, he took over the editorship of a British bodybuilding publication called Bodybuilding Monthly.
Okay.
And part of his gig was the more photographs he could get in the magazine, the more he got paid. But you need articles for that. So he'd say, oh, can you write something on, you know, this or that? And yeah, sure. Okay. That'd be kind of fun. And I went and covered one of the Olympus, Mr. Olympia contests in Columbus, Ohio. Might've been 1990 or 89 or one of those years. No, it had to be before that, 86 or 85.
86 and, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was, I wrote about the contests, but he also allowed me a bit of latitude so I could write about training. And so I would go into the physiology lab at McMaster University and pour through all the physiology stuff and tie it to what Mike Mentzer had advocated. Like if I found writings on intensity versus duration from, let's say, Arthur Steinhaus, who was a guy who taught in Illinois. Great. And one of the sort of the pioneering exercise physiologists in the United States.
Okay.
I found that it dovetailed beautifully. So I used to write these articles on intensity training, high intensity training and anatomy and all this stuff. And Chris could then throw his photographs in, you know, and so it was nice. And that eventually caught the attention of Joe Weider, and he asked me to go to California and write for him. So
that's what
I ended up doing.
Wow, that's amazing. What did you think of the 1980 Mr. Olympia result, John? Because this was like 6 months after.
I thought it was great. I thought it was the best, most honest run contest I've ever seen.
The highlights, the IFBB.
It was, well, I got a lot of mixed feelings about the 1980 Olympia, and I'm beholden to you for your research and speaking to a lot of the people that were there on your podcast. that's been an education for me. I've always known, of course, what Mike's views were, but to get them substantiated by other competitors was an eye-opener. My view on the contest at the time was that Arnold should not have won. And that was largely from the articles that were coming out at the time, like Jack Neary's piece.
Jack Neary,
I was surprised that Mentzer didn't, because I think he clearly was the favorite going into 1980, with particularly with Zane's accident.
Right.
He seemed to be the guy that, okay, he's the one to keep your eye on.
Yeah.
And then find out he got fifth place. It was like I might even have been able to accept it if he'd gotten second place. And you say, well, it was Arnold, right?
Right.
But then when you look at the contest and you see that Arnold didn't even do the compulsory poses, that's like hitting a ball in baseball and refusing to touch the bases. You know, you don't count the run.
Right.
So at the very least, he should have been marked down for that round and probably disqualified. And if you believe what Frank Zane said to you, Dennis Dallard did disqualify.
Yeah.
And rather than respect the officials on the stage, they instead fired Stallard. Send him back to Wales.
That was amazing when Frank said that.
That to me smacks of corruption, you know. Yeah. And the judging panel was certainly all friends of Arnold. And the Brendan Ryan substitution, where he gave Arnold perfect scores in the first round, where he should have been marked down for symmetry issues or proportion issues.
Yeah,
he didn't do the mandatory poses, and he got a perfect score for that, for not doing them.
Right.
And then in the posing round, where Arnold, you know, would have excelled, because even if he had weak points, he was savvy enough to know how to cover them. And the body parts that were very well developed, he didn't, you know, he was fantastic at showing it.
Right.
But instead, he got marked down in the posing round.
Yeah.
Which is bizarre.
Yeah.
And then, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but my experience when I covered contests was that really the first three rounds determined the contest. The pose down is to give the judges time to tally their scores. It's kind of, it's a bone to throw to the crowd.
Right.
So I guess during that period at the pose down, he got more points.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
I don't know. But anyway, perfect scores. You know, Arnold was sort of the antipode of Tom Platz. You know, Platz had the big legs, upper body wasn't in proportion.
Right.
Arnold had the big upper body, but the legs weren't in proportion.
Right.
In the same way that Platz got marked down and penalized over his career, Arnold in that contest should have been marked down as well.
Yeah.
So my thought on the 1980 Mr. Olympia, to answer your question, is simply not that, you know, so-and-so, Mike or Frank or Boyer should have won, but that Arnold should not have won.
Yeah.
That's basically my conclusion.
Yeah, that's what Boyer Coe said. It wasn't like he didn't really know who should have won, but they all felt like Arnold shouldn't have won.
Yeah, and they all – it's interesting. I looked at your interviews with these champions pretty thoroughly and who they picked. And these aren't fans. These are guys that have been in the trenches. They know what it takes to win an Olympia, in the case of Samir or Chris Dickerson or Frank Zane, who won it three times.
Yeah.
So by an actual highest possible level bodybuilder standard, they didn't have Arnold in the top five.
Right.
All of them had Mentzer in the top three or as vying for first place.
Mm-hmm.
What's it mean? Nothing, unfortunately, because it's in the books. But you had said something in your podcast which struck a resonant chord with me. You said, I forget whose podcast it was, forgive me for that, but you were being interviewed and this fellow raised a good question. He said, so even if Arnold was out, there's no way Mentzer was going to win the contest, right? It was Dickerson.
Yeah.
And you said, well, it depends on the judges, right?
Yeah.
Different set of judges, just like the bodybuilders' opinions, they could have voted someone else in first very easily.
Right.
And when you look at issues like mass and proportion and conditioning, I think Mentzer was right in there.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like, I talked to Winston Roberts, who was a judge from Canada, a well-respected judge from the IFBB, and I got a chance to interview him right before he died, unfortunately. And I was asking him about the 81 Olympia, where Franco won.
You were
Franco,
at that one.
And I was at that one, yeah. And Franco had weak legs. And he was talking about Platz, and he said, yeah, he was he was out of proportion, so that's why he marked him down. And I wish I would have pushed him a little more, you know, when I had the chance, because yeah. I would have said, well, you marked Franco higher, and he had no legs. You know, it doesn't make any sense. Can you reward a guy for better development than less development? You know, it just doesn't
Yeah, matter. That's right. Yeah, less is okay, but too right. much, got to draw the line.
Right, so. Right. So as you got a chance to know Mike, you've probably known a lot about his career, right, John? And so let's talk a little bit about his career for our listeners that aren't aware of Mike. Here, I just showed you this. I'll show it again for the camera. This is one of the first bodybuilding magazines. I think this is the very first cover I've ever bought. Yeah. This is crazy. April 1976, Muscle Builder. And Mike was on the cover. And as you said, John G. Mosey was the writer. And this was right after Mike was in the 1975 Mr. America, AU Mr. America.
Well, it wasn't the 76 then.
It was the
76.
Yeah, it was right after 75 that Robbie won. And this was right. Mike's, I guess, first big national contest. And he was right. third place behind Roger Callard and Robbie. And I guess Gene Mosey wanted to do an article on him because he was a new face, upcoming star. And he was absolutely shocked, you know, in this interview that how little he trained. He said he only trained 3 days a week. And at the time, everybody was training 6 days a week. And everybody was doing at least 20 sets of body parts. Because I remember this is when I got into bodybuilding. And all the articles I read by everybody all said the same thing. They were all doing six days a week, training each muscle group 3 days a week. And then Mensah comes along and he goes, no, I'm only training 3 days a week. And I'm only doing like five sets of body part. Gene Mosey was just blown away. He couldn't believe it.
He said, you're giving me a snow job. That's what he said to Mike in the article.
Oh, really?
But yeah, no, that's fascinating. And it's funny, if you have ever spoken with Dave Mastroikas, he and Mike were very tight in and around this time.
Yeah.
And he shared with me the letters that Mike sent him from Deland, Florida, when he was, I think it was 71, maybe, training and the routine that on the Nautilus equipment that Arthur had put him on. And it was essentially that routine that he took to the America, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I interviewed Dave. Yeah,
three days a week. And he didn't really deviate from 3 days a week. He did tell me in 1988, I remember asking him what his most productive routine was. Because Mike had run the gamut. Being a bodybuilding fan like you and I, he was into it. You know, whatever, what do you got?
Yeah.
So he started out with a very basic routine. In fact, if you can remind me to come back to this later in our talk.
Okay.
There's some points I want to examine with you. But he did a basic routine that you got with your barbell set. He had a Billard barbell set.
Okay.
And it was 3 days a week. It was, you know, two or three sets an exercise, about seven exercises. And as a youngster, as a 15-year-old, his body just ballooned. Like he went from, I don't know, he gained something ridiculous, like 20 pounds of muscle in like a year or something. And so it was pretty clear his genetics were good. And then he trained with power lifters, and then he got the muscle magazines, and he trained like Bill Pearl did. And then he had pictures of Arnold, believe it or not, up on his wall, and trained like Arnold. And he knew Larry Scott's routine and everybody's routine. And then, you know, as a result of meeting Casey Viator, and Casey trained basically the same way that Mike described to Gene Mosey.
Yeah.
It was an epiphany moment for Mike. It was like, well, wait a minute, I don't have to train this way. This is interesting. And he put him in touch with Arthur Jones. And Mike went to Florida after he got out of the Air Force and wrote these wonderful letters to Dave, which he has preserved quite a few of them, which are fascinating, the real timepieces, you know. But that's how he trained. Yeah.
Back then. Yeah, I remember the pictures of Mike from the Teenage Mr. America. Or was it the Mr. America that Casey won? It might have been the Mr. America that Casey won.
Yeah, in 71.
71, yeah. Because I think him and Casey were the same age. So I think they were both 19 at the time. And I interviewed Dave Mastroikas, and Dave told me that story too. He said right after that contest, he called up Dave and he said, I was in the Mr. America and I got 10th place or something. And Dave goes, wait a minute, you were in the Mr. America? He goes, yeah, but that's not important. He goes, what's important is I met this Arthur Jones, and I got to tell you about this new training, you know, this new way to train.
Yeah.
And he looked amazing at 19 years old, though. I mean, you're talking about his genetics.
Oh,
he looked amazing for 19.
Oh, for sure. Always had great proportions, very small waist.
Yeah.
But I'd gotten off track, which I have a tendency to do. Mike still maintained that three-day-a-week protocol. And when I asked him about his most productive routine, he was onto a split routine at that point. Half the body, one workout, day off, the other half, day off. And then he said, yeah, and the only difference was, he said, I added an extra recovery day in there. So rather than train Monday, Wednesday, Friday, it was, you know, Monday, Thursday, Sunday, whatever it happened to be. So his adherence to those fundamentals of intense, brief, and infrequent never wavered. And I do see periodically on internet forums, you know, where people will say, oh, he never trained the way he advocated. You know, he was doing four sets of bodybuilding. That's nonsense. You know, it's not. Usually it was said by bodybuilders that were contemporaries who didn't really do much in terms of mail order business, and they were a little envious of that.
Yeah.
So, of course, what Mike was peddling was bullshit, and what they're selling is the truth, you know.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the case.
Yeah, well, right after this magazine, Mike went on to win the 76 Mr. America at IFBB, and I guess he made incredible improvement in that 1 year, and he blew away, well, he beat Callard, who beat him the year before. He also beat Danny Padilla, and I guess he looked amazing, you know, as far as the improvement he made in that 1 year.
Yeah, yeah, almost unrecognizable, according to some. Yeah, he beat Callard, and I don't think Robbie was in that contest.
Mike, well, Robbie won in 75.
Mike loved Robbie Robinson. He thought he was awesome. And,
yeah.
And he was, in some respects, that was his bench, his measuring stick was Robbie. Mm,
okay.
So he lost to Robbie in a Night of the Champions in 79 and said, you know, deservedly so. He said, Robbie looked amazing. I could tell
when
he took his shirt off that the contest was over. But he also beat Robbie at one of the Grand Prix shows too. So they always had this rivalry, and Mike had huge respect for Robbie Robinson and his physique. And he liked his character, actually. He mentioned that several times to me, that he said, you know, Robbie's got a good character. I really like the guy. So by contrast, it's funny. I asked him once, just out of curiosity, oh, you know, who are your friends, you know, in bodybuilding? And he said, oh, well, Boyer Co. You know, geez, that's not really very many, is it? I said, no. And he goes, no, it's funny. I don't have a lot of friends in bodybuilding. He said, I don't really have a lot of friends generally. He said, I tend to keep to myself.
Yeah.
Friendship for Mike, he didn't care to have a lot of friends, but the ones he had, he was very close to.
So, yeah.
You know, in that respect, people like Dave and myself and a few others were fortunate to get into his inner circle, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's amazing because I got into bodybuilding right at this time. And like I said, I remember everybody was doing this high volume training. And I don't know how many people actually, I don't think a lot of bodybuilders actually followed Mike's training verbatim, but he did really change the sport a lot, because I think he did bring up this idea of intensity versus recovery. And I think it made everybody question, hey, why are we training 6 days a week? And why are we training 20 sets of bodybuilding? Is it because Arnold does it? You know, and because this is just the way it's done. And I think that's what it really was. I mean, that's why I was doing it. I was doing it because Arnold did it and everybody else did it. But then when he started questioning it, and then he started saying, well, he's right. I mean, we can't train long and hard. You know, you can't do that. And I remember it did affect everybody, I think, as far as recuperation goes. You know, like I know I started training 4 days a week instead of six. And my gains, I made much more gains. You know, I didn't take the intensity into the level like he did, you know. But I did cut back on the amount of sets. I did have more rest days. And I remember I talked to Phil Williams, who won the Nationals in 1985, and Phil was living in St. Louis, and I guess Mike came over to George Turner's gym and did a seminar, and Phil at the time was training 6 days a week too, because that's what George advocated. And Mike did the seminar, and he was saying about how you need more intensity, and with the intensity you have to take more recuperation. And Phil still follows that philosophy to this day. He'll take like one or two rest days after every training session, you know. And he said once he did that, it made a huge difference in his career, you know.
Well, a lot of it, like you say, was ritualistic. It was, you train that way because so-and-so from the past trained that way.
Yeah.
And he trained that way because someone else further back trained that way.
Right.
And it was all tradition and ritual. It had very little science or even critical thinking applied to it in terms of training. Like, you know, Arnold's a great case in point, because he trained the way he did because Reg Park told him that's the way you train.
Yeah.
And so who was he to question?
Right.
And what I liked about Mike and people like Mike is that they were unique as individuals. There's a great quote from Mike, which is burned into my brain, which he said, you know, a conformist says, I believe it because other people believe it. Mm-hmm. A nonconformist, he said, just as irrational, says, I don't believe it because other people believe it. Right. Said, but that rare third person, the individualist, says, I believe it because I can see for myself the reasons that it's true. Mm. And that was Mike. And those type of people generally are fascinating to be around. The conversation is the high. I mean, it's the highest high of your life to be in that environment.
Yeah.
Because your synapses are firing and you're thinking of new possibilities and, you know, you get creative. And but when it's just tradition based, it's stultifying.
You know,
it's, well, that's it. There it is. You know, don't even think about it. That's all you need right there.
Yeah.
But I remember a friend of mine was big into Larry Scott when I was getting into weight training when I was a teenager. And he had all Larry's courses. And, you know, Larry Scott looked amazing, you know, and, but it was 20 sets a body part. Mm-hmm. And I remember going through a couple of workouts with him like that and just thinking, you know what, I can't do this. There's no friggin' way I'm going to be able to hit the gym 6 days a week for 20 sets of body part.
Right.
Even then, you know, it was like, this is ridiculous.
So,
of course, if Arnold said it, then it was true for me.
Yeah.
You know, I bought his Education of a Bodybuilder. That book was like holy writ to me. You know,
right.
My older brother bought it for me and I poured over that and poured over that and the exercises Arnold advocated.
Yeah.
Incline presses for the upper pecs after doing bench presses and flies. And I mean, and I will say this about Arnold is that he certainly is a great salesman. Bodybuilding has never had a better salesman than Arnold Schwarzenegger. Because he sold me and millions like me over the years.
And I remember when Pumping Iron came out, when he would do interviews with, like, the regular media, people didn't know anything about working out, to show the intensity or the dedication of a bodybuilder, he would say, I trained 5 hours a day. I don't even think he trained 5 hours a day, but he would try to sell that, and then they would believe it. Like, oh, they equated that with how much hard work this guy's putting in.
And that still endures to this day. Like, for example, you have a great physique, and I'm sure when you grow up, people say, oh, John Young, you must work out every day.
Right.
Oh, well, yeah, no, I don't.
I hear that all the time.
But they expect that, because if you're that much bigger than normal, you must be just putting in more time.
Right.
And Mike was the first one to say, you don't need the time, you need the effort.
Yeah.
And I liken it to riding a bike, if you will. We've all had that experience. You can ride for hours on the flat. And if you're riding with another person next to you, you can carry on a conversation and you're not even aware that your muscles are working.
Right.
But then you come to a hill. And as you start to go up the base of the hill, suddenly you're aware there's something of a metabolic nature going on in your quadriceps.
Yeah.
And maybe the conversation now is a little stilted. But you continue on, you continue on. And then when you get closer to the summit, your legs are on fire. Your chest is heaving.
Yeah.
And you got to get off the bike because you can't complete the revolution of the pedals and you're panting for another 10 minutes afterwards.
Right.
You could do hours of on the flat riding.
Right.
It's never going to have the effect of that last 40 seconds of riding up to the top of the hill.
Right.
Because when you're working against gravity, the muscles are working harder.
Yeah.
So the harder the work you do, the greater the metabolic effect, including muscle growth.
Yeah.
Stimulation for muscle. And that, I think, is what Mike was getting at, was that it's that hard effort that you want. If you want bigger, stronger muscles, you got to empty the tank.
Yeah.
And, you know, the gas comes out of the tank so gradually when you're riding on the flat or when you're doing low intensity work, that it almost, I mean, owing to things like gluconeogenesis, it replenishes itself while you're going along.
Yeah.
But if you do something demanding, it empties out before your body has time to rectify that.
And right.
Consequently, your body doesn't like it any more than you do. So it takes steps to change that. But yeah, his thing was, it's like about intensity and duration, is that the harder you train, the faster you grow. But it's also true that the harder you train, the less amount of that training you can engage in. It's like the faster you run, the less distance you can run.
Yeah.
And that seems to me indisputable, you know, from a common sense standpoint.
And, you know, when I got into bodybuilding in the late 70s, you know, when I started talking to other bodybuilders, the first gym I ever went to was a real small gym. It wasn't an actual, like, real gym. It was a bunch of guys in a garage. I think it was like six of us or something, you know. But when we would talk to each other, everybody would train the same, you know. And I think that was happening around the world or around the country where everybody was just following the magazines. And I don't think guys knew as much about steroids at the time. We would look at these guys and think, this is just training. You know, you got to train 6 days a week. And I think there were so many people that were so disappointed with their results, and they weren't taking into account, you know, the genetics that Arnold had or the drugs, which was unknown pretty much at that time. Right. Nobody really knew about the drugs. And I think when Mike brought this into the intensity and how you have to have more rest, I think once people started doing that, even average people who had fair genetic, everybody was making progress off that. It was like a breath of fresh air. Yeah.
Well, and the other thing that was refreshing about Mike was his candor. He never lied about anything, which is rare, especially in the bodybuilding industry.
You know? Yeah.
He was the first one to say, yes, you can buy my books and courses, which is great for me, but that's not a guarantee you're going to build a Mr. America physique. He said, because that is genetically based. He said, and if you don't have the genes, ain't going to happen.
Right.
And I remember interviewing him in his apartment. I'd gone to visit him from Canada. This is about 86. And I said, you know, your triceps are one of your most renowned body parts. I said, is that strictly genetics or the way you train or is it steroids? He said, well, it's a combination of all three. He said, for sure. He said, you can't get that big rip, gnarly look without steroids. He said, you just can't. He said, but he said, genetically, I've got good fiber density in my triceps and I train them hard and that's why they respond. But he was very open about steroid use at a time when most bodybuilders were like, don't talk about that.
That's true. Yeah.
He even did articles in Muscle Builder about steroids.
I remember that. Yeah.
But his attitude was he wasn't going to advise anybody on anabolics. He said, I got enough trouble in my own life. He said, I can't. So that's your decision. If you want to do it, do it.
But yeah.
He said, I did it after careful consideration, weighing the pros and cons, and thought that the pros outweighed the cons for me in that case. And I was monitored, not real closely monitored, he said, but I made sure I was blood pressure testing and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought the risk was minimal for me, he said. But he said, each individual has to make their own decision on that. And he was not anti-steroid. He was, as he told me, he was anti-drug testing. He said, you know, I believe I was born a free individual and should be able to put into my body anything I want, even if it kills me. And he said, you know, and so is everybody else. It's not my business to tell you steroids are good or bad. He goes, but I'll tell you this, and he was serious about it. He said, what pisses me off more about this whole, this was back when I was talking about the time when the IFBB was implementing a drug ban or testing.
Yeah,
and 1990. The kind of went down a little bit.
Yeah.
And he said, what bothers me are people that take steroids and then lie about it, that they don't take it.
Yeah.
He said, lying to me is more immoral than taking steroids is. He goes, taking steroids is a personal decision. You know, he said, but, and he mentioned a female bodybuilder who at the time was claiming that she never took steroids. And he said, you know, it doesn't matter. He said, anyone who's a bodybuilder knows the look. He said, you're not fooling anyone.
Right.
He said, so we know if you're taking or not, but lying about it. He goes, that was a pet peeve of his.
Yeah.
So when guys like Arnold or like Franco, who denied it or minimized the role of steroids in their training, would publish articles or be quoted on it, I mean, he just rolled his eyes. You know, these are our leaders in the sport that are advising the young up and comers about the realities of bodybuilding.
Right.
So
I remember he wrote an article about something and he was talking about his arms and he said his arms were like 18 and a half or something. I'm like, that can't be right. They got to be 20 inches. Like everybody had 20 inch arms back then, you know. But that just showed you how he was very honest about everything. And he did put it out there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 18 and a half inches. And he said that was an accurate measurement. He said my arm was cold and tape wasn't flip flopped or at an oblique angle. So we got a bigger measurement out of it.
Right.
So, his arms were ridiculously large. Again, when I visited him in his apartment, I remember he was sitting across on a couch from me and we were talking about something and he reached over to show me something and it looked like his arm blocked out his body. That's reached across.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, taken aback by it. But he was the first one also to talk about genetics. You know, he said, guys with the right genetics, he said, can do a lot in bodybuilding. He said, but guys that don't have the genetics, he goes, they can improve. There's no question.
Yeah.
They're never going to look like a bodybuilder.
Right.
And one of his indices for genetic potential happened to be bone size. If you have thicker bones, you can anchor a bigger muscle, basically.
Okay.
And that that was brought home to me at the same time when I was visiting, because I had a Swatch. You might remember those plastic watches, you know, the right. De rigueur at one point. And I just bought this, and I have tiny little wrist. And so I had, you know, thing almost cinched right up to the face of the watch. So I had this much hanging off. And Mike was in the kitchen, and he came out and he caught his watch on something and it broke. And he goes, ah, shit, you know, I broke my watch. I said, not to worry. I have a Swatch. And I took it off and I said, look at all that extra band I've got there. I said, that'll fit you. He goes, it won't fit me. I said, what are you talking about? I said, this is, look at this. I said, you know, your wrist isn't that much bigger than mine. So he said, well, okay, I'll show you. So he couldn't even close it around his wrist.
Wow. Holy
shit. That's how thick the bones were in his,
right.
His physique. So,
yeah.
It was crazy, but that was Mike Mentor.
What was the term he used, John, when he was talking about his tricep? What was the term he used as far as his muscle?
Ripped and gnarly?
No, but you said he was saying it was steroids, it was genetics. But in terms of genetics, what was the term he used for his
muscle
tricep?
Fiber density.
Muscle fiber density, okay.
Amount of fibers per square inch. Like all of us, even non-bodybuilders, we have certain muscle groups on our bodies that just have more fibers than most people's.
Right.
For me, it's always been my chest.
Right.
You know, I wish it was uniform, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
Other people, you probably in some of your clients, if you train even older clients, someone's going to have a big calf.
Yeah.
And it's all muscle. And they've never done a calf raise in their life.
Right.
I had a guy who was a client. He was 65 and he had an 18 and a half inch calf. And he'd never done a thing in his life for him.
Right.
So it was almost ridiculous to say, oh, you better hit the calf machine there, buddy. You know, yeah. There was nothing there that would benefit him. And so bodybuilders have that muscle fiber density spread uniformly throughout all their muscle groups. And the great ones have it through every muscle group.
Like Sergio.
Like a Sergio.
Yeah.
And then you have people like, oh, who's a bodybuilder that has bad calves? I mean, not bad calves, but they just don't have the density.
Yeah.
They built them up as big as they can go, but there's no more you can't stimulate into growth fibers that aren't there.
Yeah.
So,
the guy that comes to mind right now is, I'm thinking the guy that beat Mike at the 77 Universe, Cal Skalak.
Yeah.
He had this great upper body, but his legs were just never, they could never match up to his upper body.
No, he just didn't have the calves, you know, and
yeah.
or even the quads.
Even the quads, yeah. I went to a Boyer Co seminar once. And Boyer Cole said he saw Cal train his legs, or he might have wrote an article about it. And he said he trains his legs super hard. He goes, it's not like he's not training them. It's not like he's neglecting them. He just doesn't have the genetics for it, you know. But that's an interesting concept, muscle fiber density. That's not talked about a lot, you know. And I think when people talk about genetics, they just say genetics, and that's just a general term. But they don't get into, you know, like different bone structures or muscle fiber density or things like that.
Yeah. Well, and that's a biggie. I mean, if you don't have the fibers there to develop, they're not going to. And
right.
If you have, like, for example, let's say I have, pick a number, 400,000 fibers in my biceps. Arnold may have 800,000.
Yeah.
So he and I can build our arms and effectively increase the size equally, but his are always going to be twice as big. Because he's got more fibers in there.
Right.
And genetics isn't talked about, and it wasn't talked about until Mike came into the mix, because there's no return on it. what can I market you? You know, if the genetics are the ultimate determinant of bodybuilding success.
Right.
I can't sell you a supplement. I can't give you a special technique that's going to induce hyperplasia.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to, that's the ceiling. And most of us, not all of us, most of us bumped up against that ceiling about 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we keep looking around for a different technique that's going to drive up this adaptation, because we don't want to let go of the dream, you know.
Yeah.
But I think reality sets in, or it did for me, that, you know what, John, it ain't happening. So if I maxed out my muscular potential, however modest, it makes zero sense for me to try and up my training.
Yeah.
I'm not going to drive any further adaptation, but I am going to induce a lot of wear and tear on my body. Like, I don't know any varsity athlete, level athlete, that isn't arthritic, that hasn't had a hip replacement, a knee replacement. When the hinge joints in your knees and your elbows, aren't that dissimilar from the ones in your door. And you have a lifetime of normal use built into both of those. Now, if someone goes out for a bicycle ride, and that's their form of exercise, it seems pretty innocuous. You don't get the pounding, you get running, you know, your muscles are working, but yeah, you're also opening and closing that knee joint with every revolution of the pedals. And even on a half hour bike ride, you can easily open and close that joint 10,000 times.
Wow.
So it's like going to your door and opening it 10,000 times, 4 days a week, over and above its normal rate of use.
Right.
You're just going to wear out the hinges. And
yeah.
And I see that in bodybuilding. I think it's an issue that where the chickens will come home to roost for people down the road. When you're in your 20s and your cells regenerate relatively quickly, yeah, you're bulletproof. You don't really care about it. But
yeah,
it's almost like imperceptibly that switch gets shut off once you exit your 20s.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you get the odd ache and pain that's hanging around when it shouldn't be there. And
right,
the meniscus in the knee starts to thin out a little bit. So I think, in my own opinion anyway, that revisiting what Mike advocated and seeing how it might apply to you, to people generally, is a good thing, because you cut down on a ton of wear and tear. The amount of muscle you're going to build is fixed. It's genetically predetermined. We don't know how much it is until you train.
Right.
But at some point, the end is coming. So, you know, as Mike said to me, rather than trying to see how much training or exercise you can tolerate, maybe take a look at how little is required.
Hmm.
And that was like,
yeah,
makes sense. So
the one thing I think Arthur Jones lacked in promoting his philosophy of training was, I mean, he had Casey Viator, and I think he tried to get Sergio Oliva to follow his protocol, but I don't think Sergio really did. But he didn't have a superstar bodybuilder who was winning contests. So when Mike started doing that, and he won the universe, and then he was in Joe Weider's magazine all the time because he was one of the editor-in-chiefs, I think, and he was writing articles every month. So he was constantly in the magazine and being featured on the cover. So now you had a guy who proved that it worked. You know, he was following this training philosophy, and he was winning contests. So I think that was really great for advocating what Arthur Jones was.
Oh, he did more promotion for Arthur Jones than anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason I like Nautilus Machines is because of Mike Mentzer, full stop.
Right.
Arthur Jones didn't interest me. Anything Arthur Jones had to say about exercise or bodybuilding that was of interest, I'd get it from Mike. Mm-hmm. He'd give me the Reader's Digest version.
Yeah.
But I didn't care that he hunted elephants. You know, I didn't care that he developed a steady cam thing for wild cargo adventures.
Right.
Didn't interest me. Mike Mentzer interested me because he right. was, you know, he was the guy on that. I mean, he did so much. He wrote the foreword to Ellington Darden's book on bodybuilding for Nautilus.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I bought the book.
Yeah.
If it was Bob Birdsong writing it, I probably wouldn't have been interested. You know,
right.
But it was Mike
right.
Mentzer. So he did a lot for Nautilus. And it's too bad, in a way, it didn't work out for him there in 1983 when he went back, because he could have been their best spokesman, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what happened with that? Didn't Arthur want to buy a television studio, and he wanted to do all these things before cable television took off, right?
Yeah, he had a massive TV station there. And his goal at the time, I believe, was twofold. One, he wanted to get a lot of programming out to what was then cable news.
Yeah.
And produce all of these shows. And number two, he wanted to sell his company. So he wanted to pump up the sales, get the numbers up, sell it.
Mm-hmm. You know,
make money and get out.
Okay.
And he went to recruit Mike Mentzer in Palm Springs, at Mike's home in Palm Springs. Arthur went up to visit him and said, I want you to come work for me. And, you know, the future is going to be television. It's going to be video. I want you in on it from the ground floor. And at that time, I mean, it was good timing for Mike because he wasn't doing anything. You know, he'd been essentially blacklisted in bodybuilding.
Yeah.
So, you know, his income at one point had been about 300,000 US a year, which is good money back in 1980.
Yeah, real good money.
Mail order courses and seminars.
Wow.
And within 4 years, it was down to zero. You know, Mike told me that at one point he was going into hotels early in the morning and eating scraps off room service trays.
Gee.
That's how bad it got.
Yeah.
So anyway, he went to DeLand, and then Arthur basically didn't do anything with him. Just say, yeah, film that workout. And Mike was waiting for like, what are we doing? Like, what's the plan? You know, and there was no plan.
Mm.
So after about 6 months of that, I think Ray had a falling out with Arthur, and thereafter Mike's enthusiasm petered out and he left, and that was it. But wow. It's too bad, because once the company sold, the company that bought Nautilus also bought Schwinn Bike. Mm. And their thought was, we have two brands we want to sell. Arthur Jones' view was Nautilus was total fitness. You get strength, you get range of motion or flexibility, and you get a cardiovascular benefit from training properly with resistance training.
Hmm.
The new owner said, no, no, no. Nautilus is strength training. Schwinn is our cardio.
Right.
And then the next step was, you know, Arthur Jones said, my machines are as big as they are and as ugly as they are to do the job they need to do. But the new owners came in and said, Jesus, how much money do we have in steel in this unit? This is huge.
Right.
What about these cams? Can we make, you know, use aluminum? Or hey, how about Kevlar? Let's get rid of those chains. And we'll pitch it as smoother, less friction.
Right.
Less friction. I've never had a friction issue on a Nautilus machine. Whenever I've pressed the super slow people or anybody about these retrofits and all this, they point to a Nautilus machine where the bars that go up and hold the plates are warped. So you do a rep and the plate would go up and the bars would warp out and it couldn't go any higher. And like, oh, right. Look at that friction. That's not friction. You got a warped bar back there. You know,
right.
The Nautilus machines, the first generation Nautilus machines, put a lot of muscle on a lot of people. And if that was friction, so be it. It seemed to do the job. It provided resistance to contracting muscles. And that's, as Mike said, it made it easier to work harder. That's what they did.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to John Little for that great interview. Next week, we will have part two of our interview with John, where we'll continue talking about Mike Mentzer. And we'll also talk a little bit about Bruce Lee, who John is also a real expert on. And he's written several books on Bruce Lee and also done some videos. So that's going to be really interesting next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring this episode of the show. I also want to thank all our Patreon donors. If you're interested in helping contribute to the show, just go to bodybuildinglegendshow.com, which is the official website of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And in the upper right-hand corner, you will see a link for the Patreon donors. And this week, I am sending them a preview clip from part two of our interview with John Little, so they're going to get to see it before anybody else, because they are helping out and contributing to the show. So I really do appreciate you guys. And that is it for the show, guys. We will be back next week. I hope your workouts are going good. Stay safe out there. I know these coronavirus cases are getting higher again, especially out here in Florida. So I hope everybody's safe and hope everybody's healthy and enjoying their workouts. And we'll be back next week with the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Take care.